Governor Holcomb finishes signing all of 2019's bills. The gaming bill and its conflicts. That, plus Todd Rokita's new gig, and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending May 10th, 2019.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Built on a 100-plus-year foundation of legal service, Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients stay ahead of a changing world. Working to develop an understanding of each client's needs to help build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, Governor Holcomb closed the book on the 2019 legislative session by signing the last of 293 bills sent to his desk. Holcomb signed the final three bills just ahead of a Wednesday deadline to make a decision on legislation, a measure aimed at reducing infant mortality, legislation to create an underground carbon dioxide storage project in Terre Haute, and this session's major gambling bill. It's the second consecutive year Holcomb signed every bill sent to him, and over three sessions in office and 778 pieces of legislation, Holcomb has only vetoed one bill. That was a measure imposing fees on the public's access to records from Holcomb's first year in office. Is Holcomb's lack of vetoes a positive? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwanes, host of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly, Statehouse reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting Statehouse reporter Brandon Smith. Ann Delaney, is this just good cooperation between Holcomb and legislative leaders?
What it means is that Governor Holcomb has absolutely no spine, is what it means, okay? I mean, he came out early for a comprehensive hate crimes bill. What did he do? He folded when his caucus wouldn't go along with him. He came out early for a real improvement in teachers' pay. He folded when the push came to shove. You would think that, for example, on early childhood education, he could have done some initiative on that. No. I mean, they talk about how they expanded it. They expanded it because they didn't spend $14 million last year. There are people dying to have adequate preschool for their children, and we're not providing it. So, no, I mean, he's a go-along. He's nice enough, personable enough, but he's a go-along kind of guy. He's never going to have the leadership necessary to take us, as he would like to say, to the next level. Because that requires you to stand up and stand for something and hold to that position, and he's not capable of doing it.
Is that what this is?
No, not at all. I think it's a style question. I think we all know that Eric Holcomb isn't a stand at the podium and, you know, and pound your fist kind of leader. He's never going to be that. The governor's office, and the governor himself, with leadership on a weekly basis, on a daily basis, the session drew closer to the end, was talking to legislative leaders. It's not like 293 bills showed up on the second floor and they went, oh my God, what is all this? You know, they were engaged in every part of the process of working through the issues that they did have with legislation. Some of that didn't move forward at all if they opposed it or if the governor opposed it. And some of it was changed if they had issues or there was an opportunity to do something big. I do think he had some big wins this session. I don't think many people are talking about it, but accelerating I-69, if you just think in like a 2-year context of when he took office, what a mess that was. Now he's not a legislature for all kind of the chest thumping about him going forward without their approval. Basically, you know, just endorsed the program that he wanted. So now only are we going to finish
ICC.
They ended up taking that money for NCTI. They instead found $205 million in excess highway funds we didn't know about.
They needed a win. Yeah. Everyone won is the point. So
is this in part a consequence of there's two Republican supermajorities and a Republican governor? How much are they really going to disagree on?
Oh, I think a fair amount. I mean, we've seen that probably the toughest job in the legislature is trying to herd these supermajorities, because when you have that many people and you have a quorum, regardless of whether the other side shows up or not, that tends to cause a certain kind of fragmentation, it seems to me, ideologically.
And that falls more on Brian Bosman and Rod Bray than it does Eric Holcomb.
Correct. I guess my thought is that by not using his veto pen frequently, I mean, that ink is just pretty, he won't be replacing a cartridge in that pen for a long time. That doesn't necessarily suggest weakness, though. It may or may not. It may be that he's getting what he wants during the process so that he doesn't have to...
Like the hate crimes bill.
It's framing. I mean, it reminds me, I've said before, of what Mike Pence used to do when he was governor. He said, well, I'm putting up guardrails. This is a highway. And as long as the legislation is between these guardrails.
As long as it doesn't do anything, I'm going to
well,
win.
Well, it was a six-lane highway, I guess,
on biased crimes. He was very specific about what he wanted. Now, ultimately, this legislature couldn't get there. But
with super majorities, they couldn't get there.
I would also point out that
with a very conservative legislature, you couldn't get there.
Well, then you veto it.
A veto is symbolic.
Then you veto it.
But is something better than nothing on hate crimes?
Not that bill. No.
Keep in mind, it doesn't mean anything. I mean, it's all a simple constitutional majority to override.
Right.
It's not as if this is two-thirds.
Make them vote.
All right.
Just take a
position. It's more symbolic than it is anything else.
Is this also a consequence, and you might kind of allude to this, because I think Mitch Daniels was perceived as being very good at this, Mike Pence not so good at this. Is this a consequence of Eric Holcomb being good at managing the process during the session so that maybe some bills that he doesn't like don't get to his desk at all?
There's clearly a lot of communication going on between him and legislative leaders, so there weren't any sort of last-minute surprise bills. But I also think it's fair to point out that the reason there aren't a lot of last-minute surprises is because they're having all these discussions behind closed doors and in caucus, and the public isn't getting to be a part of that.
Well, time now for viewer feedback. Each week, we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question, is Governor Holcomb's relative lack of vetoes a positive or a negative? A, it's a positive. B, it's a negative. Or C, it's really neither. Last week's question, would Richard Lugar or Birch Bayh win a statewide election in Indiana today? 20% of you say Lugar would, only 4% say Bayh would, 15% say both could, but 61% of you say neither would win a statewide election today. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, Governor Holcomb signed into law this week a gambling bill called Monumental and Transformational for the Industry, but it's also a bill that attracted controversy and conflicts as it made its way through the legislature. The gaming bill makes major changes. It clears a path for new casinos in Gary and Terre Haute and legalizes sports wagering statewide, including mobile and online sports bets. But during session, multiple issues of conflict of interest popped up around the bill. First was Governor Holcomb getting flights on a private jet from Rod Ratcliffe, who owns the Gary casinos and is considered the most likely to open the Terre Haute facility. Then, some tried to make hay out of Speaker Brian Bosma recusing himself from votes on the gaming bill because he did legal work for a Vigo County entity that at one point was mentioned in the measure. Bosma's recusal went above and beyond the legislature's ethics guidelines. And then in the wake of session, the Indy Star reported Carmel Republican Jerry Tor voted for the gaming bill after he had done title insurance and closing work for Spectacle when it purchased those Gary casinos last year. Tor did give up his commission for that work before casting votes for the bill. Mike O'Brien, let's be direct about it. How much do these ethics questions around the bill matter to voters?
I think if there were actual ethical issues, then it would matter to voters, and it should. These are not actual ethical issues. The only reason anyone knows about this is because it was either self-reported or, in the governor's case, the campaign benefited financially from some activity, and that's required to be reported and made public, and all that should all be the case. We have a citizen legislature that we don't pay very well, and we force them to go out and do other things in life. We have, if you run and get elected as a state rep or a state senator, you're probably pretty successful in other parts of life, and you're involved in kind of big important things. But we also set up a process, an ethics committee, and a bipartisan process that usually unanimously decides whether or not there is an ethical issue and you should recuse yourself, or there isn't. And even when they decide that there isn't, as the case with Speaker Bosma, he says, look, there's not an ethical issue here. This does not meet the standard of law. But from a perception standpoint, I'm out of it. But we just crucify these guys when they follow the process, when they disclose, when the Ethics Commission decides on a bipartisan basis that they're not making a bad choice. And then so the ethics issues are just insinuations by some members of the media that don't accuse anything. Because, look, Brian Bosma practices law, and, he's been to Terre Haute. It's ridiculous.
Mike makes the point that we know about these things largely because they were reported through the processes that you report them. Isn't that a sign that things are working the way they're supposed to in this system?
I don't think the ethics laws in this state are tough enough, frankly. Okay, and I understand the risks of a citizen legislature. But for Jerry Tor, for example, to say he didn't take the fee, okay, did it go to his employer?
He did the title insurance. He's not selling slot machines,
man. That's okay. He's selling title insurance, and he's bringing that work into his employer, and he's going to get credit for it, okay? And they went to him as opposed to any other title insurance company. Why? because he's the greatest title insurance person in the state, or because of his legislative activity. So that presents a problem, okay? And likewise, it presents a problem for the governor flying on that plane, going out there and raising money and doing it again through the back door. You can't have entities that deal in gambling contribute directly to candidates here, but what you can have them do is contribute to the RGA, who turns around and gives it to the governor. So the ethics rules are not tight enough, and it isn't just a function of the citizen legislature. There's a difference between passing and voting on a bill that has a wide-ranging impact and voting on a bill that puts money in your pocket. And that's what the problem with these two
this
are.
Didn't do.
And this is why this brings up the old expression that Governor Holcomb used to use when he was state chairman, a culture of corruption. And that's what this looks like.
On the Holcomb front, doesn't it just feel unnecessary? He didn't need to take private flights from a guy who owns the casino.
No, he certainly didn't. He could have paid for them. His campaign could have paid for them. I mean, the fact is that Indiana law says gaming interests cannot give to campaigns, and it's there for a reason. And whether it went to the RGA or not, he directly benefited from that. And that, I think, is a legitimate question. Now, some of these other ones, I have to admit, I agree a bit with Mike O'Brien. I feel like if they have any involvement with anything, we're just painting it all as a conflict. Jerry Tor, for instance, though, to be honest, he could have easily recused himself. That bill didn't affect his district in any way, but he chose, to go ahead and vote.
And it didn't need his vote. It didn't pass by one vote.
Exactly.
It was a little close at the
end. But he didn't recuse himself.
He did not.
Not right away, at least. Is it heightened because this is a gaming bill?
Sure. Oh, the stakes, pun intended, are incredibly high when you have these kinds of bills. This is not your mom-and-pop issue where there's some fringe elements that are concerned. This is the big money. But I don't think, points well taken all around, but I don't think this issue has legs. Because if, in fact, one of the key players in this casino battle or this bit of round of jockeying for the advantage in this session had gotten burned and had desire to gin up the controversy in some fashion to say, look, this is clearly a sign of corruption. That's why we got burned and somebody else came out ahead. But instead, as we have talked about on this show before in recent weeks, everybody more or less went away happy. There was something to placate.
The folks in Southeast Indiana, I don't think would agree with that.
Yeah.
But they did. I mean, they got the free.
They still got something. So I guess I don't think their animosity rises to the level that they would, again, gin up.
I don't think you understand how these stories are coming about.
Yeah. I'm saying that people forget about things when they can start betting on their phones, when they can go and have live dealers at the racinos. I'm not sure this lingers unless somebody makes it an issue. Now, if there's something else that comes to light, that was some sinister, nefarious activity, well, then that perpetuates it. But I think in this instance, it's pretty much over.
Well, former Indiana Congressman Todd Rokita has a new gig. He's been nominated by President Trump to serve on a federal board. Trump nominated Rokita to sit on the board of directors of the National Passenger Rail Corporation, better known as Amtrak. The position does require Senate confirmation. Rokita served 8 years in Congress representing Indiana's 4th District. He left after a failed bid in the Republican primary for the U.S. Senate in 2018. He since took a private sector job at healthcare consultant firm Apex Benefits. His legislative service included time on the House Transportation Committee and its Railroad Subcommittee, but Rokita also repeatedly voted to defund Amtrak while serving in Congress. Nikki Kelly, most political watchers here assume Rokita still has political ambitions in Indiana. How does this play into it at all, or is this just something to get by?
I think it keeps him in the right circles in case he's not sure what he wants to do in the future. I find it fascinating that, he was appointed or nominated, I guess, with his history of being so against federal funding for Amtrak. And, it has not been easy to get confirmation to that board, so we'll see if it works.
Yeah, is there a nomination fight to play out here because of his past votes on this issue?
I doubt it. There are bigger fish to fry in Washington right now. I don't think that this would engender a lot of anger on the part of Democrats and those who might be frustrated by his record. The irony, it seems to me, is when you look at his old district, the 4th District, and where if you look at the map, and then you look at the one instance where Amtrak actually still has a presence in Indiana, which is the line between Indianapolis. Well, it's still
half of it is still there.
So what? July, the subsidy stopped because the General Assembly did not choose to subsidize it. So Amtrak is going to, barring surprise, barring Herculean action by Todd Rokita.
I don't see that coming.
So it'll go away. But if you look at the map and that rail line, it went right through the 4th District. So it's just a bit of irony, I guess.
I mean, he does have, I mean, as I mentioned in the piece, he served on the Railroad Subcommittee, the Transportation Committee. So there's bona fides here.
He's qualified for sure.
But does it look good to nominate someone to a board that he would very much like to defund entirely?
Maybe he wants to go fix it from within.
Is that what we're putting our money on?
I do think it's interesting. I think there's been one senator from Colorado who held all these, is holding these up. It's a real old school political move, which I kind of respect, where he's holding it up so Amtrak puts more stops in his state.
We're the only developed country
in the world that doesn't have transportation by rail.
It's ridiculous.
And putting him on the board, I mean, talk about putting the fox in the hen house. He wants it to. He doesn't believe in it. He doesn't believe in rail transportation.
Or at least
and we would be
for it.
Well. It's got to get subsidized.
It should all be privatized.
Oh, I see.
I'm sure that's
I see. It's okay to put federal funding to pave roads, but not to put it on trains. Is that the idea?
Where does this
go?
Might we have an EPA appointee who wants to do away with? I mean, that's crazy talk.
Sounds like President Trump doesn't have that.
Time to move on.
10 Indiana school districts asked their voters to approve extra funding measures in this week's elections, and not all were successful. Six of the May primary election's 10 school funding referenda passed this year. That included the biggest ask in a community just outside of Gary, a property tax rate increase of more than $1 per $100 of assessed value. The smallest school referendum request this cycle in Plymouth School Corporation failed, an ask of just 19 cents. Four school districts made first-time requests of the voters, and they were a split. Two approved, two denied.
John Schwanis, does it become harder to make the case to lawmakers that they need to devote more resources to things like teacher pay when these local referenda fail?
Well, there's no doubt that people are trying to read a lot into what we saw at the ballot box here, and we get these referenda go back to 2008, and of course, if you look at it, this is the least successful pattern, or the ratio of success to failure is as low as it has been since 2011. So, there are those who are saying, oh, this is a sign of some sort of groundswell against school funding. I, for one, think it's much more locally focused. And when you look at school board or school referenda, it seems to me oftentimes there's an issue that's driving it. There's one personality that's driving it. It may be somebody popular, somebody who's ready to go up on a community dartboard. I'm not sure you can read a whole lot into these types of referenda.
I'd still like to try.
All right. Well,
no, but I mean, we're going to have
a show.
We're going to have more school funding conversations at least for the next couple of years, particularly around teacher pay.
And they just approved a new school safety referendum.
So we're going to see more referendas.
Now, I will say, I agree with John a bit on this, though. I think these are very hyper-local. There was one in Northeast Indiana that failed, and most of the community loved about half of the project, but then they threw in synthetic turf and a new field house. And at that point, when you start doing the over-under, it's like, we want to fix the boilers and improve the cafeteria. But, you know, we're not on board for a $10 million field house. So I just think local schools need to be really careful in this climate.
Yeah, is this hyper-local and you can't read too much into it?
It's local, but it's also, it seems to me, a sense of frustration that they're not getting the funding that was promised when Mitch Daniels said that the schools would go off the property tax and the state would fund it, because the state hasn't funded it. They're not funding it at the right levels. They're not paying teachers at the right levels. I think there's a sense of frustration among people. And then they issue a press release saying it's historic funding, and then people are asked to vote to put more funding in there. It's not historic funding in the sense that it's real money, real increases in revenue for those schools. And I think people were misled by a lot of the rhetoric that came out of the State House after the session and thought probably that there was enough funding in there, and there isn't.
That makes me, when you hear the lawmakers saying, historic funding, we've never given schools more, and we've raised it higher than we ever raised it before, does that say to voters who are then asked to vote for a property tax increase to pay for their schools, well, Why do we need to do that?
Yeah.
Yeah, it gets a little tricky. I mean, the message of that gets a little tricky. I think there's school districts throughout the state that had a really good, this is a really good budget for them. There's places where it isn't. That's just the reality, and it always has been. I agree that these are really local. I've been around a few of these, and it comes down to, like, neighbor fights. You know, I mean, it's, like, not nice. But we also put these superintendents in kind of a bad spot where they've got to go be campaign managers. They've got to go raise money, and we tie their hands. The law's kind of written so it will probably fail because we just put so many restrictions on how it can be run and when you can talk about it and who you can talk about it to and how you actually message this stuff. So there's a lot of rules around it that kind of bend it toward failure anyway. But I think if we've had great examples in Hendricks County and elsewhere, where I'm from, of our superintendents going out and making the case and then ultimately getting approved because the communities wanted to invest more in the schools.
Well, this week's municipal primaries also produced a shocker in the region. Gary will have a new mayor this fall.
Incumbent Democrat Karen Freeman Wilson lost her reelection bid to Lake County Assessor Jerome Prince. Freeman Wilson has been mayor of the Northwest Indiana City since 2011. Prince is no political newcomer. He's been an elected official for 19 years, serving on the Gary City Council and the Lake County Council before becoming assessor. And the field was a crowded one, with 7 other Democrats joining Prince in a bid to unseat the incumbent. Freeman Wilson was previously Indiana's attorney general, appointed to that position in 2000 by Governor Frank O'Bannon before losing an election to keep that seat to Steve Carter.
All right, Ann Delaney, I'm all about starting rumors here on the show. What about Karen Freeman Wilson for Attorney General next year?
I think she'd make an excellent candidate for Attorney General. I'm not concerned that she lost that. It was a very divisive primary with so many candidates, and every time you run for the third term, it's a little tricky. But she's a very qualified woman and would make an excellent Attorney General. I'd love to see her run.
There's a real chance that the Attorney General's next race next year in Indiana could have a little more attention than the AG's races usually have. Is this the sort of candidate that might be good for Democrats?
Typically, Democrats pick their candidates at the last minute because nobody really wants to run for these statewide offices. So maybe. I mean, she and Mayor and Governor Holcomb, of course, had a great partnership up there with some of the investments that the state's making in Gary. So it's a loss from that standpoint. But we'll see how the new guy does. Yeah.
I actually
the
wanted
new Democrat
to ask.
Does.
Yeah, the new Democrat does.
Yeah, yeah. There's really no chance a Republican's going to win that race.
I'm not going to argue about that at all.
Yeah.
Good for you.
I actually call that one. Mike brings up something that I'm actually curious about, which is we've seen Karen Freeman Wilson down at the State House over the last several years more than a few times because she was working with Republican leaders, because you have to work with Republican leaders if you want to get something done. Especially around the new gaming issue, which is billed as an economic development boom for Gary. Does this change the trajectory of that at all?
I doubt it. I think the wheels are already rolling on that because I think to the extent that it could have been, the deal could have imploded, it would have occurred during the session. I think now that we have the agreement that we have, there would be very little that would stop it.
Mike brings up the point that we often don't see the Democratic candidates for some statewide offices until like the last minute before the convention. Is this one that might benefit from a little further
ahead? I think we will
ahead?
Definitely see an advance candidate for Attorney General this year.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Well, finally, the Kentucky Derby produced a stunner this week when the winner, Maximum Security, was disqualified for blocking another horse, meaning that Country House was declared the victor. And I imagine anyone who had Country House would be overjoyed enough to say, toss dollar bills from the balcony of Millionaire's Row at the track. Mike O'Brien, how would you celebrate such a shocking win?
I'm really not the kind of guy to throw dollars around. I'd probably just hang out in the background and smoke a cigar.
How would you celebrate a win like that, Ann Delaney? A shocking reversal win like that?
Well, it depends on who I had bet on. If I had bet on the new winner, I would be very happy. If I had bet on the loser...
Champagne for everyone.
Champagne for everyone.
I was at an entirely different horse race. My son's graduation from Indiana University. Would he do it? Would he not? I mean, I had placed my bets that he would, and he came through.
I imagine you put a lot of money on
barring
the fact that he was...
Yeah, barring disqualification, yeah.
How awful... I mean, I imagine any time you lose, when you're betting on a horse race, it's got to be not a great feeling. How much worse if you had Maximum Security and then they lose like that?
Oh, that's awful. I mean, especially if you're betting on it, you won.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now you're waiting for your bets to get paid out.
This time next year, we can all bet on mobile...
That's right. We can all
either
be overjoyed or suffering through quite a disastrous loss at that point a year from now. That's right, because it starts September 1st.
Yeah, because I don't have another graduation until the following May. So
you're really going to be paying attention.
Or you could all sign up for the mini marathon and do that instead of going to watch horse racing.
I wouldn't put money on me doing that. That's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwanis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at wfyi.org/IWIR. Or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the new WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller, built on a 100-plus-year foundation of legal service. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients stay ahead of a changing world, working to develop an understanding of each client's needs to help build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com. The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.